Let's talk about gifts that have been received, but I want to talk about particular types of gifts this morning. I want you all to give me some examples of gifts that you have received that you have particularly cherished. Gifts that you have received that you have particularly cherished. Okay?
A new friendship.
Can you give me some examples of what that looked like? How did you cherish it? Okay. Yeah, which demands vulnerability sometimes, making yourself open to someone, taking a risk. Yeah, good. What? Yeah.
How
have you cherished it? What have you done to cherish it? Okay, you're going to put it on display so you can share it with others.
Hanging in the dining room right now.
Okay, which means that the most important room in the house gets it, right, which is the meal room. Absolutely. You put it in the meal room so you can see it at least three times a day. Cherishing means to display. What else? What other gifts have you all received that you have cherished particularly? Yeah. Gifts that you have cherished, and how have you cherished them? Yep. Isn't it? How have you cherished it? What have you done to cherish it? What is? You watch it. Yeah. You watch it over and over and over again. Dr. Maitley, have you seen it? Yeah. Good. What else? What other gifts have you received that you have particularly cherished, and what have you done to cherish them? Bingo. I know exactly what you mean. I do the exact same thing. I can think of one particular instance when I had made a very, very difficult decision. As a matter of fact, it had been the wrong decision, but I had made it. And then once I had made it, I had to turn my back on it and do the exact opposite. I told someone that I was going to come and do something, and then after I realized it was the wrong thing for me to do, I had to call them up and tell them that I'm not going to come and do it. But it was the right decision for me to back out. I remember that Chuck Swindoll found out that I had done this, and he wrote me a card telling me that he too had faced issues in his life where he had made a decision, but it was the wrong decision, and he had to back out, and how traumatic it was to back out of a bad decision. He wrote me a card to tell me that he was with me. You know where that card is today? It's on my desk. Right smack dab on my desk. I see it every day. And anytime I'm feeling a little bit down, that card comes out. When you cherish something, you store it away for safekeeping. You pull it out again. It is something that you treat differently than you treat other things. You treat it different than you do a bill, don't you? You don't treat a bill like you treat a card that was written for your encouragement.
Oh, yeah, they sit out on my desk all the time.
you don't treat a cheap old throw blanket the same way you treat a specially made quilt, do you? You don't treat a CD of the latest Christmas tunes, right, the way you treat a CD or a DVD that was made for you by your daughter with specifically claimed and represented memories. Right, when you cherish something, you treat it completely differently. You put it front and center because it means something more to you than anything else. I remember my dad gave Pamela a gift. I didn't get the gift. He gave it to Pamela. I get to share it, but he gave it to Pamela. We couldn't afford it, but he gave it to Pamela, and so now Pamela has it, and I get to share it. Its name is Gracie. It's a 7-pound silky terrier that we had to search all over the United States for, and when we found it, we had to fly down to Houston to get it. This runt of a silky terrier puppy that we found in Houston. So if you believe this, we got on an American Airlines flight, flew down to IAH, rented a car, drove to this house, and walked into this house all to buy a dog. But we immediately fell in love with this thing. She was as quiet and as fearful as she could possibly be. She didn't let out a peep when we took her in our arms, or Pamela took her in her arms, and we cuddled her all the way to the airport, got her on the plane with us so she could sit with us in the cabin, she was as quiet and as scared as you could possibly imagine. We didn't know what this thing was going to become. But what this thing has become is something that we cherish. As a matter of fact, we cherish her to the point that no longer does Gracie sleep in a crate. We tried that game, but Gracie had other ideas. Now Gracie sleeps in the bed. And Gracie doesn't want to sleep on top of the bed. Gracie, like everybody else in the house, wants to sleep under the covers. And so every night, Gracie comes to bed and she goes under the covers and finds her place and sleeps in the bed like everybody else, because that's what everybody else in the household does. Gracie gets treated differently. Why? Because Gracie is cherished. Gracie is a gift given that we treat differently than we treat other things in the house. When you cherish something, that something becomes front and center. That thing becomes displayed. That thing gets treated with honor and with dignity in the way in which other things that you own do not. In the book of Genesis chapter 2, God gives a gift which he intends to be cherished. And ladies, I hate to disappoint you this morning, but what we're going to talk about the rest of the morning doesn't have a thing in the world to do with you. You're completely out of the picture. This morning, we're talking to the guys. So ladies, you can leave, or you can stay and you can watch, but the rest of the morning is for the men in your life. This is one of the hardest lessons I ever teach when I run across this passage, not because it's hard to understand or hard to talk about or hard to interpret. It doesn't take a lot of exegetical gymnastics in order to find out what the passage means. But I tell you, this is one of the hardest texts I ever face in my entire life, because it is one of the hardest biblical passages to do consistently and to do well. I specifically hate to teach it whenever Pamela is in the room. Because whenever Pamela is in the room, I'm held accountable. Because it has everything to do with her and the way in which I treat, nourish, and cherish her. So ladies, you're welcome to listen and to watch. But the passage this morning just isn't about you. Guys, it's about us. Genesis chapter 2. Now God had put him to sleep because he wasn't much good for anything else, because remember, he was alone. God had put him in the garden to tend the garden, but apparently he was in the garden, tending the garden, but there wasn't something quite right, because Adam, God said, was alone and it wasn't good. Even though he was in a relationship with God, even though God was right there, and even though there was someone else with which Adam could have a relationship, namely God, God still considered Adam, even in relationship with him, to be alone. And it wasn't good. So he put him to sleep. And while he was asleep, he reaches inside him, takes a rib, a bone with some meat and some flesh hanging onto it, and out of this bone and out of this flesh of Adam, he creates Eve. Remember the song of praise that he sings, the first hymn of praise recorded in the scriptures? He wakes up and the first thing that he does is he sings a song of praise in verse 23 of Genesis chapter 2. This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. Did you catch it, guys? Let me read it one more time. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. Here in Genesis chapter 2, before the family has even come into existence, before the first opportunity to have a family has even taken place, God announces that there is one reason, one fundamental basic reason why a man is to leave his father and mother. He is to leave and he is to cleave. He's to say goodbye to one and he's to say hello to another. He is to take a knife and he is to cut the strings that tie him to the one, and he is to sew strings which now unite him to the other. Notice again the language. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. Why? Because notice, the woman was taken out of man. It's the woman that was taken out of the man. It's not mom and dad that were taken out of you, fellas. It's the woman who God has given you as your wife that now is the analogy to the relationship that Adam had particularly with Eve. And it means that since mom and dad didn't come out of us, that the first step that a man takes in becoming a man in this world is to take a pair of scissors and to cut his strings to mom and dad, and to realize that since mom and dad did not come from him, but the wife which God has given him has, is he now strings himself to her and cleaves to her and no longer to them. You know what Christian counselors tell us? Is that the number one reason why many marriages fail is because the man has forgotten to leave his mom and his dad. He continues to bring mom and dad into the home, continues to bring mom and dad into the relationship, holds more honor and more loyalty to mom and dad than he does to his wife. Which is why the best biblical counseling comes smack dab center at the very beginning of the Bible. That any healthy Christian marriage is going to start with the man's responsibility of leaving mom and dad. And that can take on a whole bunch of different forms. Sometimes it means that physically you've got to leave mom and dad. It may mean that that certainly you've got to leave them physically, but it also means that emotionally they have got to be left. There may be certain things about mom and dad that are unhealthy and unhelpful and, may I put it a little bit stronger, toxic for your marriage. And so the first step to a healthy marriage is that mom and dad and the man's loyalty to mom and dad must now take second place to his loyalties to his wife. For this reason, because she was taken out of him, for that reason, the man is to cleave to his wife. And all relationships, particularly the relationship that was previously prior with mom and dad, must now be subordinated to the relationship to his wife. But notice, it's more than just leaving. It is also that he is to be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. The text occurs in Genesis 2. But it's interesting that the Apostle Paul pulls it out again in his letter to the Ephesian church. Ephesians chapter 5. When he's writing to the Ephesian church, he feels it's necessary to remind the Ephesians about what was introduced way back in Genesis chapter 2. Notice Ephesians chapter 5, the verse occurs one more time. Notice verse 31. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. Now, he puts the quotation from Genesis 2 into a paragraph in which he is teaching the men of Ephesus, the Christian men of Ephesus, what their relationships to their wives are to be. Now, if we looked up further into the chapter, say beginning at verse 22, we could read some of the stuff that Paul says to wives. But you know what? In our household, it's not the habit for me to read Pamela's mail. In our household, if Pamela gets a letter, Pamela gets to open that letter and read it for herself. If she wants to share it with me, she's welcome to do that. But in our household, we don't go around reading each other's mail and making each other's mail the main thing that we're interested in. So, fellas, today I want you to read the mail that has been written to you and not the mail that has been written to your wife. Because the Genesis 2 passage occurs in the mail that is being written specifically to you, not to the mail that's been written to your wife. So let's read the letter that God is declaring should be read by the men of the church of Ephesus and by the men of the Sunburst class. Husbands, verse 25, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. In this same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. After all, no one ever hated his own body, but he feeds and cares for it, just as Christ does the church. For we are members of his body. For this reason, now the quote from Genesis 2, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is a profound mystery, but I am talking about Christ and the church. However, each one of you must love his wife as he loves himself, and the wife must respect her husband. What's the word, guys, that occurs down through the passage over and over as the command which is to describe the relationship between the husband and his wife? Love. That's the main word that comes out time after time after time. He is to love his wife. But notice the relationship between Christ and the church is also talked about, and the word love is used there to describe that relationship. Notice verse 25, Christ loved the church. But what other terms or what other actions are employed by Paul as he describes Christ's relationship to the church? Besides love, what other terms or what other activity does Paul describe Christ enacting in relationship to the church? In particularly in Ephesians chapter 5. I'm sorry? And where do you see that? What verse? Yeah, verse 29. After all, no one ever hated his own body, but he feeds and cares for it, just as Christ does the church. Notice, feeding. And what was the other one? Caring or nourish. Yeah. What other terms are used to describe how Christ is relating to the church in Ephesians chapter 5? Sanctifying. What does sanctifying mean? Set apart. And particularly here, what does it mean for Christ to sanctify the church? What is he trying to do with the church by sanctifying it? Make it holy. Yeah, notice verse 27. And to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. Yeah, to sanctify her, to make her holy, to present her without blemish, to present her without, right, without fault, and otherwise to purify her. What else? What other terms does Paul use as he describes the relationship of Christ to the church? How does Christ love the church? What about verse 25? Christ loved the church and what? Gave himself. Notice that what Christ does is he gives himself. See, this is what you do when you cherish something. When you receive a gift in price and in worth and in value above every other gift, this is how you treat it. You love it. You provide for it. You care and you nourish it. You sanctify it in order to remove impurities and to purify it. You give yourself for it. To what degree, by the way, did Christ give himself for the church? Completely. To the point of death. And he's not just talking here about the crucifixion, but the trial that preceded it, the whipping, the crown of thorns, the spear in the side, the nails in the hands, the nails in the feet. That when Paul talks about this text from Genesis chapter 2, that a man is to leave his mother and father and to cleave to his wife, he sees this text as not only describing what I am to do in relationship to Pamela, but also what Christ did in relationship to the church. Did Christ leave his father in order to tend to the church? Absolutely. Did he leave the glories and the comfort of heaven? Did he come down and assume the form of a human being? Did he give himself? In other words, what Paul is saying is that there is a mystery involved in Genesis chapter 2, which is only fully explained and displayed when you look at Jesus Christ. The one who leaves his father and mother so he can cleave to his wife are not only the men in this room, but our model for what it means to leave and to cleave is Jesus Christ himself. Because she was created out of us. Because she was taken out of the man. The man is to link himself to her. And the way in which he does this is by loving her, by feeding her, by caring for her, by sanctifying her, removing impurities and blemishes from her, by giving himself for her. When this text appears in the New Testament, Paul wants us to know that the men in this room are not the only ones who have been called upon to do that, but that Christ did it first. And Christ did it best. And that the model for a Christian marriage, what a Christian marriage is to look like, and the responsibility primarily rests upon the shoulders of the husband, in the same way in which the creation, sanctification of the church rested upon the shoulders of Christ, is that what a Christian marriage ultimately looks like is the crucifixion. What the Christian marriage ultimately looks like is the slaughter of the Son of Man. What a Christian marriage ultimately looks like is the humility of Jesus Christ, the self-giving of Jesus Christ, in order to build up and to serve and to cherish and to nourish the one that God has given to him, which in Jesus' case was the church, and fellows, which in our case are our wives. You're going to receive a lot of Christmas gifts this year, perhaps. But you know what? There is a gift which God has given you already, for which you are primarily responsible. And what it means is that this Christmas season and throughout the entire next year, you have been given one gift that is to be the front and center of your lives, and your relationship to that gift is to be characterized by self-sacrifice, by humility, by giving of yourself every ounce that you have so that that gift might be cherished, nourished, provided for, taken care of, and displayed as the one which is the most important gift that you have received. When Paul talks about marriage, he goes back to Genesis chapter 2, but he also thinks back to the crucifixion in order to display what it ultimately means. You might like to look at this afternoon, but Peter does the same thing in 1 Peter. When he talks about marriage, do you know what his Old Testament text for marriage is? Isaiah chapter 53. What goes on in Isaiah 53? It's the story of the suffering servant of Israel who gives himself so that others might be blessed, and so that others might be nourished and taken care of. Gentlemen, you've received a gift, but that gift came to you with amazing responsibilities. Leave and nourish. Leave and provide for. Leave and sanctify. Leave and feed. Leave and give. Leave and love. Feeding, by the way, means a lot more than just providing for physically. Emotionally, you have an awesome responsibility. And your responsibility is to spend more time reading your own mail than that of your wife's. Leave and love. A couple of minutes here. What are some ways in which feeding and giving need to take place in terms of our relationships and responsibilities to our spouses? Let's have some of the ladies join in now, too. Not only a relationship to our wives, but let's talk about marriage. What are ways in which we feed, nourish, and care for each other? I'd like to hear some of the men first. What are the ways in which you need to feed, or what are some of the ways in which you need to be nourished? Or sometimes you wake up and the woman of your dreams has another dream of her own. I'll tell you what it is with me, fellas. It's writing papers, speaking at conferences, my laptop, checking the web. These are the things which students, these are the things that interfere with leaving and cleaving with leaving and loving. You're absolutely right. Listening. Actually hearing what is said without being distracted by what your mind is overcome with. A student, a web page, a paper you're writing. What else? How does that take place? What does that look like? Can you give me an example of what that has actually looked like, maybe once in your life? How was encouragement actually performed for you? Yeah. And that is so helpful to be the spiritual encouragers for our mates, to remind our mates in moments of complete emotional devastation that God is still involved and that God has not left. Sometimes those are the kindest words our spouse can give us, is to remind us of the presence of God in a moment of complete devastation. One more. Yep. Humor is sometimes the last bastion, isn't it? If someone can make us laugh, this is a huge uplift. It's a step out of the hole of darkness if someone can just go to some effort to make us laugh. Even if it doesn't work, the fact that they tried means the world. Put him on display. That's what we do with things we cherish, right? Yeah. Would you just leave, please, Steve? Who can measure up to this guy? Absolutely. He needs to come down to our level, to my level. That's great. Yeah. Absolutely. Sometimes it's only when you're afraid they're going to slip away that you actually cherish what God has given you and that we've taken for granted. Absolutely. Isn't that sweet of Him? Yeah, we can pray this, fellows, that we learn to cherish our spouses without the trauma, right? Let's not wait for trauma to happen. Here's a very expensive question, guys, and don't ask it in case you're willing to pay the price of listening to it. Sometime this Christmas season, just sit down with your wife and say, "What does it mean for me to leave and to love?" For you, what does it mean for me to leave and to love? Are there ways in which I haven't left? And are there ways in which I haven't loved? It's a very expensive question. But it's a question sometimes which we all need to have the courage to ask, and the fortitude to respond to. So, Father, by your mercy and by your grace, would you make the men of the Sunburst class husbands which imitate Jesus Christ Himself. And for those in this class who do not have wives, whether because they've lost them or they've never had one, would you help them to love others within the body of Christ with the same type of cherishing and nourishing that we as husbands are responsible to love our wives with. We ask it through the Son and by the Spirit. Amen.